From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about the end of UWM's atmospheric science program and the uncertain future its students face.
I'm so tired of waking up every day wondering what classes are being offered. And then I turn to the news and they're like, hey, your entire livelihood, your entire passion, probably going to be gone by the time you graduate.
Then our Making Wisconsin series dives into the history of sanctuary in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and our country.
Sanctuary now has a very specific political connotation. And of course, that's very much connected to the question of immigration and the way in which immigration activists have taken up that term, especially since the 1980s, as a rallying cry to really create these spaces of safety for undocumented immigrants and refugees in this country.
Plus, in our Tavern Tuesdays series, we'll learn how Wisconsin reacted to prohibition. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. UW-Milwaukee's Atmospheric Science degree program will close at the end of this school year. That program prepares students for careers in weather and climate forecasting and research. UWM says the program is ending due to low enrollment and faculty retirements. Its closure comes on the heels of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration facing federal cuts to its research and staff. As Lake Effect's Exgrid Nunez explains, that means UWM atmospheric science students are facing the loss of their degree program and an uncertain job market.
The first blow to UWM's atmospheric science program happened in 2023, when the university shut down its Innovative Weather Center due to funding. Innovative Weather gave students real-world forecasting experience. The next year, in spring 2024, UWM Atmospheric Science faculty warned students that the degree program itself was at risk of closure. UWM Junior and Atmospheric Science Club President Cade Barkus remembers hearing that news.
I think my initial thought was just shock in that moment of being told, hey, the program is getting cut. And from there, it was just, okay, now what am I supposed to do?
Paul Rober is a distinguished professor of atmospheric sciences, which is part of UWM's School of Freshwater Sciences. He says that as faculty in the program have retired or left, UWM has not hired enough new professors to provide the same level of instruction and research. Because of that, Rober says the faculty voted in 2024 to suspend admissions to the bachelor's degree program. Later, in 2025, they voted to end both the undergraduate and graduate degree programs.
Ultimately, the way the UW system works is the faculty have to vote on the ending of a program. We really didn't have any choice. There was no other option, as long as the university was not willing to hire new people to replace anybody who was leaving.
Rober says the atmospheric science program's small class sizes attracted students, but the low enrollment ultimately worked against them.
We've always really punched above our weight, but of course the university is looking at a metric of how many graduates you produce for a five-year period, and because we're just at the edge of that, they feel like it's not financially viable to keep us going. So that was their decision.
In recent years, UWM has struggled financially due to stagnant state funding and enrollment challenges. According to the university, the atmospheric science program had small graduating classes of about four undergraduate students and three graduate students each year. A UWM spokesperson said, quote, "The cost to maintain a small program was not sustainable in the longer term, and the difficult decision was made to allocate resources to higher demand programs," unquote. The university did not respond for comment on how much the institution would be saving by ending the atmospheric science program. Student Cade Barkus says UWM told students already enrolled in the atmospheric science program that they would receive personalized advising to help them stay on track for graduation.
We were originally told that this year everything would be fine. That immediately fell through back in October. We were told that electives would be taught out, that there was a teach-out plan for everyone, and come to find out they're not offering electives in the spring.
Two faculty members, including Rober, will be retiring, which leaves the program with limited capacity to teach the classes remaining students need. Barkus says a number of their younger classmates are transferring from UWM to atmospheric science programs at other schools, like Northern Illinois University, UW-Madison, and St. Cloud State in Minnesota. And it's not just the closure of UWM's program on their mind. Barkus is also worried about their job prospects after graduation. They recently decided to become a double major in atmospheric science and journalism, advertising, and media studies to give them more career options.
With everything that's been happening in the federal news and just a ton of layoffs, a ton of uncertainty, I decided in February that it would be time to jump the gun and get that double degree.
As part of the Trump administration's efforts to cut the federal workforce, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration fired about 800 employees in late February, and it's bracing for more cuts under Trump's 2026 budget proposal. NOAA is a leading center of climate research and provides weather forecasts across the country. Dylan Blunt is graduating with a PhD in atmospheric science at UWM this week and will soon be an assistant professor at Ohio University. He says these massive cuts to NOAA will trickle down to other climate and weather-related fields.
Along with the anger that comes with these cuts, it also comes with knowing that my future will be impacted. I'm not going into federal service. I am starting as an assistant professor. But I do need to work on research, and those come from grants from the government, like the National Science Foundation or NOAA.
Barkus says dealing with both the changes at UWM and the news about federal cuts has been exhausting.
I'm so tired of waking up every day wondering what classes are being offered. Why is there no communication? And then I turn to the news and they're like, hey, your entire livelihood, your entire passion, probably going to be gone by the time you graduate. Which again takes me back to why I decided to start that journalism degree.
They say despite all the uncertainty, they're choosing to finish their atmospheric science degree at UWM.
I think what I've enjoyed most about the program is the relationships I've made with my fellow classmates and the faculty especially. I don't feel like I'd get that type of connection anywhere else. I'm sticking it out because I've always been the type of person to advocate for myself and other people. And I also just love UWM and Milwaukee in general. Trying to up and move my whole life for 1 year, especially now that I'm double majoring, it's not something I want to do.
Barkus hopes one day they can put the training they received as one of UWM's last atmospheric science grads to work.
That was Lake Effects expert Nunez speaking with students and faculty from UWM's Atmospheric Science Program. WUWM is a service of UW-Milwaukee. This week, Lake Effect is taking a step back to explore Milwaukee and Wisconsin's immigration history through our series, Making Wisconsin. The goal of this series is to help us understand who our neighbors are and how immigration has shaped our city, state, and country. Today, we're exploring the concept of sanctuary, which has a few definitions. It's a physical space within a house of worship, but it's also been thought of as a safe harbor where immigrants and refugees can seek respite. Throughout our local and national history, there have been waves of sanctuary movements stemming from religious organizations, activists, and legislation. To help us take a look at sanctuary and how it shaped our history and politics today, I'm joined by Marquette University Assistant Professor of History and author Sergio Gonzalez. Gonzalez begins by explaining how sanctuary is defined and uniquely remembered in relation to American history.
In U.S. immigration history, people have often defined the United States as a place of sanctuary for people all across the world, refugees, asylum seekers, economic migrants, people who are looking for a new opportunity or a sense of safety here in this country. When we think even more specifically, and I think if we think of the 21st century in 2025, sanctuary now has a very specific political connotation. And of course, that's very much connected to the question of immigration and the way in which immigration activists have taken up that term, especially since the 1980s, as a rallying cry. To really create these spaces of safety for undocumented immigrants and refugees in this country.
So we're going to kind of wind the scope back and kind of go through a little chronological history, especially here in Wisconsin, but also the U.S., about sanctuary. So to localize it here, shall we start with the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin? And was this kind of our first, one of our first big public moments of sanctuary?
Yeah, absolutely. If we think about sanctuary as this kind of founding mythology of the United States, that the U.S. has always been that way, different groups throughout American history have appropriated that language to their own ends. And I think one of the most dramatic examples is in the 19th century. Abolitionists who strongly objected to the institution of slavery, but didn't just object to it in their language and their ideas or even in what they wrote, but they actually enacted it through the material work that they did, which is to say that they created movements to try to help enslaved people flee indentured and servitude and move towards the north, either to northern states that did not have enslavement or maybe crossing over into the Canadian border. And so I'm sure that a lot of listeners are familiar with the Underground Railroad. They learned about it in elementary school, but people might not know that Wisconsin had these important stops all across the southeastern parts of the state that served in the 1850s all the way up until the early 1860s as important locations for people who were coming up from Missouri through Illinois, making their way through Wisconsin, eventually through to Canada.
Now, if people are driving around the city, perhaps going onto the freeway off of McKinley, there's a mural into the concrete of Joshua Glover. And I would love for you to share a bit about his story and how that connects to some of our physical history, especially in Cathedral Square.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the most dramatic story of sanctuary in the 19th century here in Wisconsin. Joshua Glover was a man who was fleeing enslavement in the U.S. South. He made his way through Illinois and came up to Wisconsin. He was captured by these slave capturers that were a big business in the 1850s here in the United States, and he was brought to the Milwaukee Courthouse, which is now, of course, in the Cathedral Square area that we know today. He was being held in captivity there, basically waiting to be taken back to his enslaver. And the community here in Milwaukee, there was a robust abolitionist community here in the city in southeastern Wisconsin, heard about the situation of Joshua Glover, and they quickly went to the Milwaukee County Courthouse. They began by petitioning the local government the state government to release him, saying that the state of Wisconsin didn't have the institution of slavery on the books, and so this is not something that the U.S. or the state should be abiding by. But of course, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act mandated that the state of Wisconsin hold Joshua Glover to be taken back to his enslaver. And so this local community of abolitionists decided to take matters into their own hands. At the time, the Cathedral Square was not known as the Cathedral Square because the St. John's Cathedral had not been built, and it was actually in the process of being built, the timbers were laying out in front of the U.S. courthouse. So these abolitionists actually grabbed the timbers that were being used to build this church to ram down the doors of the courthouse. They grabbed Joshua Glover and they sped him off in the dark of the night, basically moving from safe house to safe house, from Waukesha back to Milwaukee, down to southeastern Wisconsin, before they eventually were able to get him out to Canada where he could be safe. And so there's this really dramatic story that happens here in the heart of our city of abolitionists taking matters into their own hands, recognizing that this law that's on the books, while it may be a question that, you know, is undisputed, this is the law of the land, it was not something that they morally agreed with, and they felt they had to do something about it.
Right, and that kind of shows, not just in this time period, but I feel like throughout history when we're talking about sanctuary, that dynamic and that tension between federal law and local law, and then if you want to get further down to municipal laws, but that contention of, okay, yes, it's federal law technically, but we don't agree.
That's exactly right. And I think we can stretch the question of sanctuary. At its heart, it's always been this challenge to a form of state power. And what the state is, of course, changes in those conversations. Is it a question of local state? Is it the state, you know, Wisconsin state law, or is it the federal power? And, you know, in this country, we have this rich and robust history of federalism, which is to say there's a distribution of power across the federal level all the way down to the local. And Americans have understood their ability to protest federal law in a lot of different ways. And, you know, oftentimes that is told in a story of the Civil War. We think about how states rejected the federal government, and this led to this great schism that leads to this, you know, this armed struggle. But it's played out in a lot of different ways across American history. And as we know, it continues to play out today, the way in which governors and local elected officials are challenging federal laws that they don't agree with, that their representatives and their constituents don't agree with.
So we're going to bump up to the 1900s here, and a few key parts of our sanctuary history for European immigrants and, of course, the Great Migration in the 40s and 50s. So let's start with the Great Migration. How is this an example of both what you call real and failed sanctuary?
Yeah, I think so. Wisconsin had a late Great Migration, it's often referred to. I think people may know the Great Migration begins really in the early 20th century. But people who are leaving the U.S. South, Black Americans who are either fleeing economic deprivation or they're fleeing the Jim Crow South system that forces them to live in the second-class citizenship, those people start coming northward, and many of them kind of end up in Chicago, so they don't actually make it all the way up to Milwaukee. And our community doesn't really start to grow until the 1940s and 1950s in large numbers, Milwaukee's Black community. And you know what? They arrive in Milwaukee looking for the exact same things that European immigrants had come to this country looking for in the 1850s, which is a new start and safety. Right? Economic opportunity and not having to look over their shoulder and fearing either you know, extrajudicial violence or violence by the state. And they arrive here in Milwaukee in the 1940s and 1950s, and sometimes they do find that, right? They certainly do find better economic opportunities here in Milwaukee than they would have found in places like Alabama or Mississippi. But they also find a new system of second-class citizenship. It's not as severe as the Jim Crow South. It's certainly not enacted with the form of violence that lives in places like Alabama or Mississippi. But they know they are made to feel like they don't belong. And that happens in a lot of different ways, whether that's at the work site, whether that's in where they're allowed to live, right? They're tightly constrained within this kind of this few blocks area that we now refer to as the Near North Side. Back then it was known as the urban core. And so Black Americans who arrive here in Milwaukee, who become Black Milwaukeeans and Black Wisconsinites, have to navigate all of these different factors.
And looking at post-World War II as well, especially in relation to European immigrants searching for sanctuary in a time of war, how did we as a nation fail to give safe harbor during the Holocaust specifically?
Yeah, I think most Americans know that the world turned a blind eye to what was happening in Europe, especially Western Europe and in parts of Germany and Austria and Poland throughout the 1930s. And of course, this all becomes extremely apparent after the United States claims victory in Europe in 1945, and you have American soldiers who are going throughout Western Europe and they see concentration camps. And it becomes very clear to Americans who are abroad and eventually as these images make their way across the world that the country had failed to offer sanctuary to not only European Jews but a wide assortment of people who had been victimized by the Nazi regime. And so there's an acknowledgement after 1945 that the world needs to do better, right? And so when the United Nations is formed after World War II, one of the most important things that they do is to establish a set of standards for how the world is responsible to deal with refugees, right? They set up this very clear standard on who is a refugee, and then the obligations or responsibilities of nation states to offer these people a sense of sanctuary, a sense of safe harbor. The entire concept of the refugee is kind of developed as a legal category after 1945. And, you know, after that period, then the United States kind of haphazardly works their way trying to understand what's their obligation to this. The U.S. does not sign on to the UN human rights standard of what a refugee is in 1947. In fact, they don't adopt that fully until 1980. And one of the big reasons for that is the United States wants to be able to do their own deciding on what a refugee is and who they're going to bring into the nation. And so after 1945, the Cold War era, the United States continues to kind of work through, you know, who is going to be allowed into this country under this idea of a refugee.
So you mentioned the 1980s, which is perhaps the next biggest and impactful wave of the sanctuary movement. So can you explain why this period is so important when we're talking about sanctuary in modern history?
Yeah, the 1980s is a period where sanctuary becomes a rallying cry for a growing movement of religiously motivated individuals who are working out of houses of worship, who see a growing number of people arriving from Central America, specifically from El Salvador and Guatemala. And these are people who arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border in the early 1980s, bearing very clear marks of the revolutions and the civil wars that they are fleeing, and specifically these repressive regimes that are sending death squads into rural areas, into urban spaces. And so Salvadorans and Guatemalans arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border. They try to avail themselves of the 1980 Refugee Act, which is this new piece of legislation that Congress has passed that has brought the U.S. into line with international human rights law. And that basically stipulates that if a person can demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution in their home country, they should be allowed to stay in the United States. The problem is that Salvadorans and Guatemalans witness a 97% to 98% rejection rate of their asylum applications. And so you have churches and synagogues in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. They see this happening. They're asking, why is this going on? And they quickly realize that this is all politically motivated. The Reagan administration is refusing to acknowledge these people as refugees because they would then have to acknowledge the United States' role in destabilizing those countries in the first place. Because at the same time, the U.S. is still sending hundreds of millions of dollars in money, in military support, in training to these countries. And so churches and synagogues decide they have to do something about it. In 1982, in Arizona and California, the first churches declare themselves places of sanctuary for the Central American asylum seekers. And they do so knowing that they might be seen as breaking the law by the federal government. Pretty soon, that movement spreads all across the country, including here in Milwaukee. Milwaukee becomes the host to the first Latino, the first Black, and the first Jewish houses of worship to become sanctuaries for Salvadorans and Guatemalans during this era.
This is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. I'm joined by Sergio Gonzalez, an assistant professor of history at Marquette University. We're talking about sanctuary as a part of our series called Making Wisconsin Our Immigration History.
With the spread of the sanctuary movement, as you mentioned, it's made up of many religious organizations as well as individuals. And one person I want to highlight is Sister Darlene Nagorski, who was tried by the Reagan administration. So can you share more about her story? This is around 1985 here.
Yeah, this is kind of one of the points I always emphasize, because Milwaukee was such an important part of the sanctuary movement in the 1980s, both because of the houses of worship here, but also the people that were engaged in the movement. One of the most important, Sister Darlene Nagorski, who was a member of the School Sisters of St. Francis based out of here in Milwaukee. She was Milwaukee born and raised. She had been sent to Guatemala on a mission trip in the late 70s and early 80s. She witnessed some of this destruction that was happening. In fact, the parish priest that she was working with was killed by one of these death squads. She was forced to bring some of her congregants northward into Mexico, into refugee camps. And so she comes back to the United States very much radicalized by what she's seen and very troubled by understanding that her country is responsible for a lot of what's happening in this country. And so she joins the sanctuary movement. She becomes really one of the most important figures in helping people move from the U.S.-Mexico borderlands all across the country. In 1985, the federal government decides to bring charges, federal charges, against some of the leaders of the sanctuary movement. In fact, they had initiated a multi-year campaign where they had been spying on churches. They had been sticking criminal informants inside Bible study meetings, inside the pews of these churches. And they bring these really dramatic charges of human smuggling against the leaders of the movement. And among those who are indicted is Sister Darlene Nagorski. The federal government, the Department of Justice, actually calls her the conductor of the Underground Railroad of the 1980s. And she wears this with a certain badge of pride. And so, in fact, she says when she's interviewed that she is guilty. She's guilty of a conspiracy of love, as she says, which is to say that her faith as a Catholic nun, her status as an American has forced her to do this work, that she has no other, there's no other out for her than to offer a form of safe harbor to Salvadorans and Guatemalans. Ultimately, Sister Darlene, along with those other leaders, are found guilty in a federal court, but they are vindicated in the public eye. In fact, the sanctuary movement is ultimately one of the most successful social movements in the history of the United States. By the end of the 1980s, they successfully sued the federal government to re-adjudicate hundreds of thousands of these asylum applications, and they introduce an entirely new immigration status into American law through the 1990 Immigration Act, which is temporary protected status.
Now, with regard to being dissatisfied with what the federal level is doing, to localize another example here, in 1986, Wisconsin Governor Tony Earl declared Wisconsin as a sanctuary state. So what does that actually mean, and how does that also give another example of that state versus federal tension that plays out?
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of listeners would be surprised to learn that Wisconsin has been a sanctuary state since the 1980s. But of course, Governor Earl is aware of what's happening, of course, right? All Americans see what's happening here, especially when these federal charges are brought against these sanctuary workers. It becomes national news. And Governor Earl feels an obligation as an elected official here in the state to recommend that Wisconsinites get involved in this work, right? He also believes that the Reagan administration is in the wrong for sending hundreds of millions of dollars to Central America. He also believes that the Reagan administration is not fulfilling its legal obligation to offer these people asylum in this country under the 1980 Refugee Act. So in 1986, as Sister Darlene is going through these court cases, as the sanctuary movement is on trial, Governor Earl, in the middle of a campaign season, right, re-election, and he decides to declare Wisconsin a sanctuary state. Now, on paper, what it means, it's mostly a statement of support for the movement. And in fact, he invites Wisconsinites to join this work as well. He doesn't have the clear statements there what it actually means for state employees or, you know, if there's going to be financial contributions to this effort, which that never actually materializes. But it sends a clear statement on where he believes the state of Wisconsin should be and where Wisconsinites should stand on the question of sanctuary.
Gotcha. So our next kind of marker of sanctuary and the movement and higher activity of this movement is under former President George W. Bush's administration. And this is specifically post 9/11. So can you explain how this event kind of restarted the movement in a more public facing way?
Yeah, the movement goes dormant after the early 1990s. The revolutions in Central America settle down. The U.S. begins to actually live up to its obligations on the Refugee Act. And so through much of the 90s, sanctuary doesn't really come into motion. It's really after 9/11 when the United States begins to ramp up its surveillance of undocumented communities. And there are growing calls to really connect questions of national security and national defense with immigration, which leads to a militarization of the border, the creation of organizations like Immigration and Customs Enforcement or ICE. And so there are more and more undocumented people in this country who feel unsafe. They feel like they can't come out of the shadows, as is often referred to. They feel like they can't live their lives in this country. And so as there's a rising number of deportations, first under George W. Bush, and then especially under President Barack Obama, houses of worship again jump into this work. There's a revival of sanctuary. In fact, the movement is reborn in about 2011, 2013 is when you start to see these really large growing numbers of churches and synagogues get involved. They call themselves the New Sanctuary Movement. And now they're offering safe harbor, not just to asylum seekers, but also to people who have lived in this country for 20 years, right? People from Mexico, from Guatemala, from Ecuador, from all parts of the world, in fact, who perhaps see themselves as Americans in all ways except for their legal documentation. They've established roots here. They have jobs here. They've had children here. And now they're fearing that they're going to be torn away from the very social fabric that makes them feel at home in this country. And so the New Sanctuary Movement kind of takes up that 100-year history of sanctuary in this country, 150-year-plus history of sanctuary in this country, repackages it and becomes another vibrant movement, especially under the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama.
Right. And to remind people, one of Barack Obama's nicknames was Deporter-in-Chief. So, you know, when it comes to having selective memory or being really involved in what's happening in the now, which, of course, is a natural human response. As you've said and told me, it's one of my favorite phrases, like nothing is unprecedented, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think I always remind my students that there's not much that's bipartisan in the history of this country. But when it comes to immigration enforcement, Democrats and Republicans have both played a very important role and created what the historian Adam Goodman refers to as the deportation machine. And so where we find ourselves today is really the consequence of course, of decades of history and of immigration enforcement.
So as you say, with the New Sanctuary Movement from George W. Bush up until today, and also with Trump's previous presidency, it's this kind of retaliation against the sanctuary movement being more broad, more encompassing. What are some of the anti-sanctuary things that are happening, whether it's on the federal level or just in public opinion?
Yeah, I think we have seen, of course, I always say that to talk about immigration politics in 2025 is to talk about anti-sanctuary politics. And the reason that is because sanctuary has served as such a robust form of rebuke to the federal government, whether it's in the 1980s, whether it's in that initiation of the New Sanctuary Movement, or specifically in the first election of Donald Trump in 2016. In 2017, we saw this kind of prairie fire spreading across the country, right? It was sanctuary kind of growing, not just in religious spaces, but also in secular spaces. places. So the growth of sanctuary cities and sanctuary states, as local municipalities made the decision to tell public employees to not participate in immigration enforcement, we saw things like the growth of sanctuary school districts and sanctuary campuses, heck, even things like sanctuary restaurants, right? And much of this was often a form of messaging to say that this is a place where we welcome immigrants regardless of their immigration status. But sometimes these actions actually had teeth, right? Which is to say that they actually served as a barrier for the federal government to enact some of the most punitive forms of immigration enforcement. So if it's an effective form of rebuke to the federal government, we might expect there to be a counter movement towards that. And of course, in the last 10 years, we have seen the growth of these anti-sanctuary politics. In fact, Donald Trump in his second election here made sanctuary one of the cornerstones of his work, right? He has gone just very, very hard against sanctuary cities during his first term and in his second term. Within the first few hours of assuming power in the Oval Office, he signed executive orders in both terms against sanctuary cities, right? Trying to bring to heel these elected officials to force them to accommodate his immigration enforcement standards. And so it is kind of the history of social movements in this country, which is to say that if there's an effective social movement, there is going to be an effective counter movement towards it as well. We are right now kind of living through the consequences of that. It is much too soon to tell what will be the outcome of this. We do know that across the federal government, whether it's at the executive branch or at the legislative branch, anti-sanctuary politics are gaining quite a purchase right now.
Well, Sergio, I want to thank you so much for joining me to take a little historical deep dive into sanctuary. It's an important movement, and it's really interesting to dive into how it's changed over time.
Thanks for having me.
Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of the books Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin, and Mexicans in Wisconsin. He joined me as a part of WUWM's series Making Wisconsin Our Immigration History. You can listen to our full conversation at WUWM.com and be sure to tune into Lake Effect every day this week for more on local immigration history. In about 10 minutes, we'll speak with a former state historic preservation officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society about the impact Prohibition had on the state. But first, we'll explore how the impact of immigrants shows up in some of Milwaukee's most beloved businesses, festivals, and architecture. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. From Pabst Brewing to El Rey supermarkets, Milwaukee is shaped by immigrant communities past and present. This week, WUWM is taking a step back to explore Wisconsin's immigration history. Today, we'll learn how that history shows up in some of our city's most beloved businesses, festivals, and architecture. Here's WUWM reporter Catherine Kokel.
Our guide for this journey is UWM Professor of History, Rachel Buff. We start with the numerous indigenous peoples who lived here, where the rivers now called the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick converged. So many native words and tribal names are now part of our state maps. Winnebago, Chippewa, and Ashwaubenon, to name a few. Even the word Milwaukee is likely derived from an indigenous word. But settlers began to leave their mark, too. Here's Rachel Buff.
We have a French and a Métis, mixed blood migration, and then some English folks coming in the 18th century as well. You can see it in Milwaukee's geography, like Yankee Hill. There are early, you know, kind of English, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants that are some of the first settlers.
Later, immigrant communities didn't just bring their names. They also brought their style of architecture and values. Polish immigrants to Milwaukee began arriving in the 1850s. Homes on the south side of the city show their influence.
The Polish flat, of course, are unique Milwaukee architecture where, you know, a family would really, Poles were very oriented culturally towards owning a piece of land, owning a house. So families would pool their resources and lift a small house up and put another floor on it so they would have more space and would be able to save money. That is a unique Milwaukee form of architecture that you can see on the south side. And it comes out of immigrant drive and ambition. And that was received as like, well, maybe they're not like us. Maybe they like living in basements. You know, that was the vibe in the early 20th century when immigration restriction was the rage.
Milwaukee also experienced a massive amount of German immigration from the 1840s through the 1890s. The city was once dubbed the German Athens, referencing the historic Greek city. German immigrants trained in politics became leaders in Milwaukee's socialist government, while entrepreneurs started breweries and tradesmen sold crafts and built businesses.
The kind of ending of the German Athens, of course, you know, we still see in the architecture of our city with Turner Hall, with Pabst, everything, with the big breweries. We still see the influence of Germans, but because of the repression against Germans, under actually the Alien Enemies Act, and the, you know, suspicion of them, that really is sort of the end of that height of German Milwaukee.
After the start of the Mexican Revolution in 1910, Buff explains that Mexican immigrants started moving to Texas and eventually to Wisconsin. She says that churches on the south side of the city began to open their doors for the new arrivals.
Sort of the transition of the south side of Milwaukee, which had been historically Polish. Again, you can still see that in the architecture, the churches, the businesses. But, you know, you have those churches kind of keeping business going by having Spanish-speaking masses.
More than 100 years later, Milwaukee's south side has transformed. Almost 70% of the residents on the near south side now identify as Hispanic or Latino, according to the U.S. Census. Buff says Milwaukee's map shows which immigrant communities were allowed to thrive and those that were left out. For example, she says one reason we don't have a Chinatown, similar to Chicago or New York, is because of extreme racism and xenophobia toward Chinese immigrants in the late 1800s. In 1889, Milwaukeeans even staged protests that ended in riots against Chinese laundrymen. In the end, all the groups that came to Milwaukee have made it special.
You can look at your map of Milwaukee, your imaginative map of Milwaukee, and you can see the presence in language, in words, in businesses. You can still go to Mater's. You know, there's Mexican restaurants. It's very different for me as somebody who comes from the East Coast, where, you know, you have Rockefeller Center and Lincoln Center. You have the Yankee names on all. You know, here the names on our high culture places are German, right? So it's written into our landscape, and it's our inheritance. It's why we have the segregation that we have. It's why we have the ongoing problems that we have that is structured in. So it's important for us to understand this, I think, both because it's our heritage. It's what's fun about ethnic festivals. It's what makes Milwaukee diverse and exciting and vital. And it's also the contested territory we still struggle with.
Today, Buff said she's excitedly following the opening of new Yemeni coffee shops and the growing Muslim American communities around the city. To see the contributions of Milwaukee's immigrant communities, both past and present, you don't need to look far.
That was WUWM's Catherine Kogel. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk on the way, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll learn about the history of Prohibition in Wisconsin and preserving some of the breweries that are still around from that era. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's time now for our Tavern Tuesday series. We're partnering with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin to bring you stories about beer and brewing in our state. We'll be sharing these histories with you leading up to the grand opening of the restored Witten Abel's Tavern at Old World Wisconsin. Today, we'll hear from Jim Drager. He's the former State Historic Preservation Officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Drager joins WUWM's Eddie Morales to talk about the history of Prohibition in Wisconsin and his 2012 book, Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
What inspired you and Mark Speltz to write Bottoms Up, and how did your background in historic preservation shape the book's approach?
We didn't actually set out to write a book about taverns. The Wisconsin Historical Society approached me because they had interest in a book on the subject. Mark and I had previously written a book together called Filler Up the Glory Days of Wisconsin Gas Stations, which is the history of gas stations in Wisconsin. And after the Society approached me, I called Mark up and asked him if he would be willing to work with me again, and he agreed. And so we ended up doing the book. My background as a historic preservation person really did inform the book quite a bit, in the sense that we were trying to recognize taverns that were, and breweries that were still intact from whatever period in time they were built in, because we wanted the people to be able to explain the history of taverns and breweries over time, and then direct people to taverns and breweries that still embodied all those characteristics that we were talking about. So you could read about how the architecture of taverns was shaped by various social, cultural, historical forces, and then you could actually go to a tavern that embodied that.
And what are some of the stories that you came across that you included in that book that resonated with you or that surprised you in any way?
Well, probably the most surprising thing is, in doing research, we picked a tavern in my hometown, and I asked a local historian if they had any historic pictures of it, and he sent me one, and my grandfather standing in the bar in the picture. He was an ice man, and he was making an ice delivery at the time that the photo was being shot, and they just, you know, brought him in to join in the photo. So that was pretty surprising.
Wow. What, do you remember what year that was?
It was probably sometime around 1900. He sold his ice business by World War I, so it was before World War I.
Yeah, that's such a cool, especially personal anecdote from that.
Yeah. But in terms of really surprising things, I think the most surprising thing I learned in doing the research was that Prohibition essentially ended in Wisconsin 5 years before it was repealed nationally. And the reason why that happened is there was, when Prohibition was passed nationally, Wisconsin also passed a law called the Severson Act. The purpose of the Severson Act was to authorize local and state law enforcement to enforce Prohibition. And once they realized that Prohibition was not, it was causing more problems than it was fixing, the state decided to repeal the Severson Act, and it was repealed in 1928. So essentially, by 1928, there were only 40 Prohibition officers in the entire state of Wisconsin. If you're familiar with Kegel Inn in West Allis, that bar was built in 1928. And when I was first doing research on it, I was really puzzled by that. I thought, why would someone build a bar when it's still Prohibition? Well, they built it because the Severson Act was repealed, and they knew that they could operate and nobody was going to stop them from doing that. So that was really surprising.
When Prohibition was in effect, how did it impact different groups of people in Wisconsin?
I think, first of all, it made ordinary people in Wisconsin into criminals, because everything that they had been doing up until Prohibition was just part of their lifestyle, and then all of a sudden it was made illegal. So there's definitely that. There was a huge economic impact, especially in Milwaukee, from Prohibition, because in Milwaukee, brewing was the fifth largest industry in the city. So when Prohibition passed, they closed down the fifth largest industry, and every brewery worker lost their job, thousands of brewery workers. All of the farmers who grew the barley and the hops, all of the bar owners, the bar tenders lost their jobs, all the equipment suppliers, the people who made wooden barrels and all sorts of brewing equipment and apparatus, they all lost their jobs. So there were thousands and thousands of people who were put out of work. And, you know, that's part of what created the traffic of the illegal traffic of alcohol, because those people just took their skills and continued to use them illegally during Prohibition.
How did attitudes towards alcohol and morality and gender? How did that shift?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, Wisconsin was one of the states that voted for prohibition, which is quite surprising considering, you know, Wisconsin's history and especially all the German and other ethnic groups that settled in Wisconsin that came from beer drinking cultures. It's quite surprising that they actually voted for it. But the groundswell for prohibition was basically a reaction to the huge social problems that were caused by excess alcohol drinking before prohibition. People before prohibition, they drank roughly three times as much alcohol as people do today. So alcohol is a huge problem, and there were no safe social safety nets to deal with that problem. There weren't food pantries to go to when your children are hungry because your husband spent all the money at his paycheck at the bar. There weren't battered women's shelters. There was no such thing as AA or any kind of alcohol treatment whatsoever. So there weren't any tools to deal with the problems of alcohol consumption and all of the problems. And at that same time, young men are flocking into the cities from the farms to work into factories. So you have this huge surge of young men, single men, moving into the cities and, you know, going to taverns. And it created some immense social problems. So there was a lot of support for prohibition because of all of those various problems.
And you mentioned the men, some of the men and their roles in that. What roles did women have, and how did their involvement kind of shape the post-prohibition bar culture as well?
Before prohibition, taverns were male spaces. And women were not allowed into taverns, and many communities actually had specific laws against women going into taverns because a lot of taverns were also brothels. So women were excluded from that, with the exception being that some taverns had what they called a ladies' lounge or a ladies' parlor at the back of the building that was separate from the tavern, closed off by a door, and women and children and families could go in there, but the bartender would not allow them in the bar. The bartender would go back into that room to serve them. But during prohibition, that gets stood on its head because when speakeasies come after prohibition, they're lawless places. There are no rules. So all of a sudden, women can go to a speakeasy if they want to. And young women are attracted to speakeasies because they're trying to throw off the shackles of their Victorian mothers and live a modern life. So they're bobbing their hair, they're smoking cigarettes, they're dancing the Charleston, they're wearing short skirts. You know, they're living a modern lifestyle, and they're listening to jazz music and drinking cocktails. So all the woman's role changes rather dramatically with prohibition because the speakeasies allowed access for women that hadn't been there for them beforehand.
With so many historic taverns to choose from to include in Bottoms Up, how do you choose which ones to feature?
Right? Yeah, you know, there are roughly about 7,000 taverns in Wisconsin. What we are looking for in the book is we were looking for those taverns that were intact from whatever period. You know, we put one in that was only 3 years old when we published the book. So we wanted them to be intact, but we also wanted taverns that would represent the entire state. So we wanted geographic distribution of taverns across the state. We gave quotas to cities. Milwaukee and its suburbs got 6 taverns. Madison got 3. Appleton got 1, and every other city could only have one brewery or one tavern. Then we drove around and looked for them. You know, we made a list to begin with of great taverns that we knew in the state, and then we started with that list and tips from people. We'd try to find them on the internet before we went to visit them so we could understand if they were worth a drive or not. And then we spent a few months just driving on the weekends and going to as many taverns as we could fit in a day. Our biggest day was 28 taverns in Sheboygan County. And we would walk in, and if they looked like they were a prospect, I would ask Mark if he was willing to drive an hour and a half to go visit it. And if he said yes, then it went on the prospect list. If he said no, then we moved on to the next one. And, you know, we visited roughly about 460 taverns in person.
Wow. Over how much time?
About 2.5 months, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty quick operation in terms of getting that list.
How can communities today preserve stories and structures of these historic taverns?
Visit them, become patrons. You know, they're income-producing businesses, and as long as people support them, they exist, and when people no longer support them, they vanish. You know, taverns are rather fragile things. One of the surprising things for us was after the book came out, we started seeing taverns that we'd featured in the book going out of business. And it made me realize just how fragile these things are. And so being a patron and supporting them is obviously very important. I think for the taverns themselves, the ones that are successful, that continue, they have some kind of niche that they belong to. They have a particular way of doing business or a particular style that is successful. But taverns aren't static. They have to change constantly to keep up with the broader business. So, you know, if you decided you're going to stake your fortune on being a craft beer tavern, that was a great idea 10 years ago. Now it's getting a lot harder because there's a lot of change that's happened just since the book came out. Younger people don't drink very much anymore. About 25% of the population of people from the age of 21 to 30 don't drink any alcohol at all anymore. So that's certainly having an impact. I think price is having an impact as things are getting tighter in the economy. People are finding it harder to go buy that, you know, $10 tap at the bar. They'd rather just drink at home. But I think the only way that it can be preserved is if people are patrons of them.
Jim Dreger is the former State Historic Preservation Officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales for our Tavern Tuesday series. It's a partnership with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin leading up to the grand opening of Old World Wisconsin's Winton Abel's Tavern on May 17th. You can learn more about our Tavern Tuesday series at WUWM.com. And that wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, our immigration history series continues with a story about Hmong refugees who settled in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.